Something Wicked This Way Comes. It's me, Martin Kessler, and joining me is Fair Thane John Lobinger.
I'm Glims and Cawdor.
Man, that's you, all kinds of fancy. So, hi, John. Thank you for coming back. For people who listen to the mainline FlixWise episodes, you were on the Sans Soleil, but this is your first time over on FlixWise Canada. And you suggested an idea that I got really excited about, which is to discuss film adaptations of William Shakespeare's Macbeth. So, what made you want to talk about Macbeth?
Well, appropriate for this podcast, probably I was just really ambitious.
Right.
I'd seen most of the movies. I watched two movies that I hadn't seen before of Macbeth, but I rewatched all the movies that I'd already seen. But I thought, oh, this is, I've seen all these movies. Let's go and talk about something. Going back and revisiting them just reminds you how many film adaptations have been made of this one play. So many of them are so good. And that's part of the reason why we wanted to talk about it. But also just because this play resonates with me quite a bit. I was a fan of politics when I was younger. And I was involved in politics as well in my early 20s. And I particularly was involved with politicians who were fairly famously corrupt. There was one guy here in Massachusetts, for the people that are listeners that are in Boston or in the New England region in the U.S., they'll know of like the story of Billy Bulger and Whitey Bulger, which was in the movie Black Mass. And I actually was working with Billy Bulger around the time that a lot of that stuff was coming out. And so I have always been interested in that space of politics and corruption and ambition. And it's stuff that I've always identified with. So when you asked me if I had a topic that I was interested in talking about, this was something that came to mind right away. So I'm very excited to discuss these movies and to discuss Shakespeare's Macbeth.
That's great. Yeah, I think these are some of the most cinematic Shakespearean adaptations. There's a lot of Shakespeare films out there, but I think maybe something about the nature of Macbeth lends itself particularly well to film. I think maybe it's how action-oriented it is. It's very violent. It's kind of like a trashy horror story at certain points, but like so many of the images translate to film in ways that I like seeing different filmmakers interpret. Would you agree with that? That maybe out of his plays, one of the ones that's best suited to film.
It's the Shakespearean play that is the best suited to film. And I'm 100% convinced of that, but I'm not the only person that believes that. Laurence Olivier should certainly know a thing or two about Shakespeare and about Shakespeare film adaptations. He never got to film his Macbeth, but he said that it was the play that he felt was most appropriate to be performed cinematically. And it's really it's a disappointment in the history of film that he never got to make his Macbeth. Many people believe it was his finest role on the stage, so it's sad that we lost it. But then on the other side of the world, Akira Kurosawa's favorite Shakespeare play was also Macbeth. So you see people that are film people above all else, they love this play. And then from my perspective, I think there's no question this is the play that makes the most sense cinematically for a number of reasons. One of them is the language. It's very beautiful, but it's simple. It's more Old English than, like, say, Latinate. And it makes the most sense to put something like this on film because it's a play that focuses on action above long language. And so that is
like Hamlet,
a major benefit.
In contrast, is like much more internal. It's all about inaction until the very end, of course.
Exactly.
You have a bit with the stabbing behind the curtain, but there's not that much that happens really in Hamlet.
In Macbeth, he takes some time because he's a moral guy. He has morals and he has a conscience. And so he takes some time before he makes his first, before he commits regicide. But then after that, but it's very quick. He has a wife, of course, who helps him move things along, some witches along the way that help him move things along. But he goes through his decision-making process, and then eventually he commits, makes a killing, and then continues to kill.
Even what you just said, like in some of these, you know, he's the good moral person who's maybe corrupted by external forces. In others, it's maybe something that already exists in him that's awakened when he sees the opportunity that witches present. And just different ways of approaching this material kind of give you a different idea of who this character is, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It is definitely treated different ways. And the reason why it's able to happen is because Shakespeare's source material is so good. Both of those things are present. You have in the hero or villain of Macbeth, I think he's both. You have in the person of Macbeth someone who, before he ever meets a witch, he's a courageous soldier, but back then that meant that he was fighting with swords and he was getting very bloody in order to win his battles. But on the flip side, when he is confronted with the crucial decision whether or not to kill the kindly King Duncan, he presents a lot of arguments to himself. And I think he, at certain points, is fairly at peace with not committing regicide. So even though he has this vaulting ambition from the very beginning, I think even before the witches see him, at the same time, when it comes time to actually commit it, he recognizes that it's wrong, and he's leaning towards not doing it, I think, until his lovely lady wife steps in.
Right. And again, depending on the version you watch, but generally she's usually depicted as maybe the more ambitious of the two, actually. Like, she's kind of the real ambition that drives him and convinces him to take that next step.
Oh, gosh. So now we're getting into the fact that there are so many film adaptations. And I think the way that you portray Lady Macbeth is one of the great choices that a director or a screenwriter makes when choosing to adapt this play. And there are many, incredible actresses and many incredible performances of Lady Macbeth. And so you could go as far as, you could go the most Machiavellian route, which is Asagi from Throne of Blood.
She's the closest you get to maybe an outright sociopathic Lady Macbeth type character.
Oh, she is absolutely the manipulator. I mean, and what is it? The Japanese, the literal translation, instead of Throne of Blood, it's, what is it? Curse of the Spider Castle?
It's like Spiderweb Castle, something like that.
She is the spider.
Right. Well, I like, on his banner, that Mifune's Macbeth is carrying around this like centipede or millipede, and it's like this bug getting caught in the spider's web a little bit, and even just like all the samurai armor with these ornate headpieces, like it kind of makes me think of like beetles and insects that are going to get caught in this web of power.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And then you have, similarly to her, but I think less of a Machiavel and more of just like pure evil, at least at the beginning, you have Orson Welles' Macbeth, and that mm-hmm. Lady Macbeth, she might as well just be another witch.
Yeah, can I say that's maybe not one of my favorite interpretations in the Orson Welles' Macbeth. I know, like, Orson Welles wanted to cast Vivian Leigh, who was married at the time to Laurence Olivier, and Olivier kind of vetoed that because he thought, well, she should be in my version of Macbeth, the cancel, the never realized one.
Oh, wow. So, this makes, I did not know that. And this makes Olivier's non-Macbeth even more tragic.
Right. Because, like, I think Vivian Leigh would have made a fantastic.
Would have been
Macbeth,
wonderful.
I know. Like, especially, like, at that point in her career. I don't know if she ever played her on the stage, but, like, I can totally picture that.
Yeah. No, that's clearly a missed opportunity. So then we go and, the way that I have always preferred my Lady Macbeth, though, I prefer to have Lady Macbeth be an equal partner in crime,
Yes.
The Bonnie to Macbeth's Clyde. And mm-hmm. I'm also in the camp of these are two fervently, like, love-struck people. And so my favorite Lady Macbeth depiction, if I don't know if it's my favorite Lady Macbeth performance, is the Polanski Lady Macbeth.
Okay.
Absolutely. That is the way that I would want to depict it, is this is someone who is a partner in crime, someone who is saying out loud the things that she knows her partner has in his heart, and is like girding him up to commit what is obviously an awful crime, but in their eyes is to further their their ambitions and increase their power.
I think it helps a lot, that version too, because I think the actor plays Macbeth, John Finch.
Yep.
Like, I don't know if he has as much personality as she does. So, like, she, you know, you kind of, it helps that that's more of an equal relationship, because she can kind of carry him in certain sections. Or, I don't know, did you find that watching it this time?
Oh, I think most people would say that she delivers a much better performance than he does. And that's tough in Macbeth.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is maybe a weird criticism, but, like, he comes across not grizzled the way you might expect, you know, the warrior Macbeth to be. I understand, like, at the time that was considered atypical casting two younger actors to play the Macbeths. Like, that's not generally how they were portrayed. So I don't know if it's, like, a byproduct of that. But I always found, like, I had a little bit of, like, a hard time trying to buy the lead in the Polanski version. But the Lady Macbeth, I think, is fantastic.
I get what you're saying on several levels. I think there's no question that the Lady Macbeth performance in the Polanski version, she does a much better mm-hmm. job than John Finch does. And I think I think if you read 10 articles about that movie, I think you would read that 10 times.
Right.
I think you're right. It was an atypical decision. I think it's the right decision to cast them as younger people that are early in deeds, and, you know, they're younger, more ambitious. It's more tragic to them that they're either unable to have children or whatever's going on with their love life, that they're not able to create heirs. That makes it that much more tragic that they're of the same age. And I also think they're deeply in love. So I think it was absolutely the right decision. And I think you're right. I think that the Lady Macbeth performance in that is so much better, which is not an easy thing to do. This is the play of Macbeth is Macbeth. It's like 1/3 of the lines are his. Mm-hmm. And with the exception of Lady Macbeth, nobody else really comes even close into how interesting they are in this play. So the fact that she was able to be so commanding in a short period of time is impressive.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting to see, like, older couples as Macbeth too, I think, because you can sort of imagine them reaching that point where life is just about to pass them by. This is, like, their last shot to kind of do anything with their lives. You know, Macbeth, he's been the loyal lieutenant, he's done his time, and it's like the employee's been there for 20 years without getting the promotion, right? They bring up the outside management instead of going to the guy who's about to get his retirement watch, kind of a situation. So, like, I think, you know, you can definitely see that in some of these adaptations. I think one of the versions that sort of offsets that age balance is the minimalist Macbeth, the 1979 one with Ian McKellen and Judi Dench, where, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Judi Dench is older than Ian McKellen, or at least she comes across that way in that version, right?
She certainly does come across that way, yes.
So, like, that's a really interesting version, because that feels much more like, you know, when you hear about these medieval era marriages where it was very much a thing of power, you know, we're going to bring together these two families out of some pragmatic decision making, you know, and she's maybe like the more controlled decision making one, and he's kind of the more youthful character that she's kind of hedging her bets on, which, like, makes it such an interesting dynamic. Like, that's not done as much. Usually they're, most of the time, they're depicted as the same age or, you know, close to the same age.
I think though that that's a newer phenomenon. I think for a long time it had been that they were not a younger couple, mm-hmm. as you had mentioned earlier. So this is, they do often do it, perform it now where it's more of the Polanski dynamic, but that is a newer phenomenon. For a long time it was, like you described, it was either, so the Patrick Stewart movie, the 2010 movie, which is one of my favorite versions, mm-hmm. that's an older man, but a younger woman who clearly is still sexually charged and able to carry children.
She was almost like a femme fatale in it, Kate Fleetwood.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Yeah. Like, that's one thing, the recent Macbeth film with Michael Fassbender, Marion Cotillard, like, I think that was definitely going for that.
Oh, absolutely. I saw one version of it when I was in grad school at Boston College, and it's the only time I've ever sent a letter to an actress.
Okay.
It was, she did such a good job, and it was like a, it was a college production, so she was a college student while I was in grad school, and I sent her an email saying I just wanted to say that was a wonderful performance, and never received a response back. Only time in my life I've sent a fan letter to somebody, because I like that way of playing Lady Macbeth as because I like the idea of the two of them being really sexually attracted to each other. I think it adds another level of excitement to the play and to the movies. So I enjoy it when that's a part of it.
I think that's sort of the magic of seeing Shakespeare performed on stage or in film, is the lines, when you just read them on the page, like, you know, they can be very beautiful and you can pick up some of the playfulness of it or the meaningfulness of it. But like, it's, you know, it's a little bit dead on the page. And for me as a non-native English speaker, like, the thing I kind of value is the story, and the story changes, you know, even if the lines stay the same, depending, you know, like you said, if it's a very sexual relationship between the two of them, or if it's very courtly and purely driven through like sort of an abstract accumulation of power, or, you know, there's many different ways the story can play out even though the lines are the same. And I find that really interesting.
Oh, I've even heard one interpretation that their relationship, the dynamic in their relationship that drives a lot of the action, is that like, essentially Macbeth is impotent.
Right.
And you can read certain, so you can literally in the specific relationship between Lady Macbeth and Macbeth, just in that one decision, you can really read into Shakespeare's language and read into the play the entire spectrum of possibilities. And Macbeth is cool because Macbeth has several opportunities like that, and you can tell where they are, you can tell what the choices are, and many of them make sense, and you can still tell the bigger story really effectively. And I think that's also one of the reasons why not only do you have so many film adaptations, but you have such a wide range of tones in these film adaptations, because they can all stay true to the story, what's in there, because Shakespeare is such a great artist that he leaves a lot of ambiguities intentionally to allow for lots of different interpretations.
Well, and some of these adaptations are quite loose. Like we've already mentioned Throne of Blood. I mean, like, there's some stuff I actually think Kurosawa manages to improve on. Like, I love...
You and I are totally on the same page here.
Okay. Like, I love the climax where... the way power kind of makes you paranoid, because it's like threats coming from all angles, how that's visually realized with the arrows coming at him from all sides. Like, you know, he's made it to the top, and all of a sudden that just makes him a target. And, you know, from being sort of like stoic at the beginning to just looking terrified as he's getting peppered with arrows, you know, like, I think that's such a great visual realization of that place that power puts people into. Stuff like that, I think it's, yep, you know, incredible.
Yeah, and I also think, sticking on Throne, well, first of all, the ending, Kurosawa was lucky that he did not kill Mifune or anybody else.
Yeah, no, they shot him with real arrows.
Because he was using live arrows.
Yes. I heard Mifune would have madness, like, nightmares about that for the rest of his life, basically.
If I were going to do my own version of Macbeth, it would be a director making a version of Macbeth who... is so bloodthirsty that he... No. So that's the first thing that everybody should know in watching this movie, is that look of terror that you see in Mifune's eyes, that's real. But the second thing is I totally agree with you. Kurosawa makes... Because Kurosawa is making a Japanese film first and an adaptation of Shakespeare second. Mm. And so his use of stories from no theater and the visuals and some of the themes and philosophies from that... and then also some of the changes he makes in the plot, which, by the way, I was just watching the movie and listening to the commentary before this. Apparently, Kurosawa and Olivier were in correspondence.
Yes.
When both of them were considering making a Shakespeare movie, I mean a Macbeth movie, and Olivier and him discussed the decision to actually give Lady Macbeth a child, which I think makes a lot of logical sense, is a really great way to understand why on earth Macbeth would go out and kill his best friend.
Right. Because all of a sudden it goes from, oh, that's great, I get to be king, to I need to protect my legacy. It completely changes that dynamic. I think it's also in the audio commentary, they point out that the Banquo character, like his banner, instead of a centipede, it's a rabbit. Like he's going to reproduce like a rabbit.
But he's also gonna die.
Yeah.
He's also going to get hunted down and killed
like a rabbit. Like that's like, again, you know, what a perfect detail to actualize this core story on film. But yeah, like it does add sort of an extra layer, this idea that Lady Macbeth is pregnant, and all of a sudden, you know, he's got to secure his dynasty, his legacy.
Because to some extent, as a person who doesn't have, as a man who doesn't have children, mm-hmm. I can understand being angry if you are unable to produce children. I can't understand getting murderously angry. But I absolutely can understand becoming murderous in order to protect your unborn child's legacy, your unborn child's inheritance. And so the Throne of Blood version of that transition from I'm an ambitious person who's going to kill the king in order to protect myself, in order to gain power and pursue my ambitions, to that next level, which is where I think most people forgive the regicide to some extent. Nobody really forgives the killing of Banquo and the ordering of the killing of Fleance.
Right.
You know, once or Mickey, which is in Throne of Blood. Oh, well, that at that point, he's
yeah,
gone.
He's
at that point.
Gone. Well, like, it becomes like the purges, like this reign of terror. Like, the Patrick Stewart version really plays that up, where it's very obviously meant to recall Stalin. You know, it correlates the figure of Macbeth with Stalin.
Oh, yeah.
You know, having Trotsky killed. It becomes like one of these, like, Stalinist era purges.
Oh, and that's a terrific version. I think if anybody out there listening has seen a bunch of these other Macbeths but hasn't gotten a chance to see the 2010 Patrick Stewart version, like, just run out and see it. It's wonderful. Has a terrific contemporary horror aesthetic that I really enjoy.
But the witches are like these creepy nurses, like
oh, there's something out of The Ring.
Yeah,
those witches,
it's like out of The
are like
Silent
cousins.
Hill or something.
Yeah, they're Japanese horror figures. It's awesome. But the other thing that movie does really well is because a lot of Shakespeare is transported to, particularly anything that has to do with dictatorship or government, they bring it to the World War II or World War I context. That's done frequently, I think. But this one's really cool because it does specifically like revolutionary Russia,
right.
Revolutionary USSR. So you see that transformation. It's a romantic transformation. Stalin was like evil from the jump. You know, he was doing
yes.
lots of evil things. But the idea of this guy who is a part of a revolution, a part of bringing forward this utopia, and trying to help free all these poor
people.
Being
corrupted by power and authority.
Being
yes.
corrupted by power. It's such a such a powerful story. It's like the reverse hero's journey. It's like the villain's journey. And so to marry those two together, I think, is a stroke of genius. And I really enjoyed that part of it as well.
And the casting of Patrick Stewart, like, I think that's so perfect because he has that natural sort of, like, usually it's something positive when you watch him in Star Trek or X-Men or something like that, where he has this natural authority to him. Any room he walks into, he's going to be like the patriarch. Like he just has that quality to him. So to see that twisted and become something very dark and evil, like, I found that very effective. You know, his voice in it, like, he's so commanding. You know, it's Captain Picard, and he's having people murdered.
I think my favorite scene in any of the Macbeths, and this is something I'm able to revise later if I come up with another one, but the one that strikes me as the best scene of all, the sandwich scene.
You're right.
When Patrick Stewart is ordering the assassination of Banquo and Fleance, so he's essentially ordering the killing of a child and his best friend, he is talking to the would-be assassins, and he's making a sandwich. And he's so poised, but yet when he holds that knife to spread the mustard, you just see this guy, one, he's cool as a cucumber ordering these assassinations, and two, he is not afraid to use that knife
right.
on anybody around him.
Right.
It is a wonderful depiction of Macbeth on film.
Yeah, but like it does make you think about this sort of strange relationship between, you know, power and the people who have it, like, is it that you have to be that brutal and horrible a person to attain power, or is it that power attracts people like that? Like, you know, you can always kind of go back and forth what the exact relationship it is, but just to see the play, or just, you know, see it realized on film, it does make you think what that relationship is exactly, and look at to the people around us and try to, you know, maybe even see if we have that potential in ourselves. And like, there's this whole thread in it of usurpation of power. It disrupts the natural order of things and we have to reset this, and it's like very brutal and violent, the resetting.
That's the optimistic interpretation of Macbeth, right? Is this is right. This happens in 11th century Scotland. The historical Macbeth also was killed in 11th century Scotland. And that's the setting of it. And so, and even the Throne of Blood, it's the, you know, it's a period in Japan where there's lots of strife and lots of warlords that are fighting against each other. And so the hope is that when Macbeth is finally killed and when Malcolm or whomever is the rightful heir to the throne, they're going to come and restore peace and you're going to have like the viable nation state. Mm-hmm. But that's the optimistic version, is that this is like some crime against nature, what's happening, it's going to be rectified and good governance is going to return. Sure. But the best film adaptations do a very good job of pointing out that is not really what is happening in Macbeth. What's really happening in Macbeth is this is eternal recurrence. Mm-hmm. Throne of Blood begins and ends, you know, with essentially,
yeah,
this is all going to happen over and over again. As long as human beings continue to be filled with ambition, as long as there are governments, you're going to often attract the wrong people to mm-hmm. the government, and this sort of thing is going to happen over and over again.
Right.
So,
I think the Polanski version as well sort of ends with the witches, right? Like, it kind of goes back to that, and it's like you said, this eternal recurrence that sooner or later this will happen again.
Absolutely.
There's that line, like, forget what it is exactly. It's like, you know, our country can't be called our mother, but our grave, you know, like Macbeth, he's just turned this fertile motherland into a place where people die. Like, it's just horrible. I was thinking, watching the Orson Welles version, especially, like, there's this interesting relationship between the sort of paganism with, or
it's like medieval. Well, yeah, there's a conflict between medieval Christianity,
yes,
which is represented by those big crosses on the sticks, versus
when,
like,
Macduff shows up and it's like a little bit goofy, the cross and the hat, but like, you get the message.
Well, Orson Welles does a few things to do that. Not only does he have all those old school Christian crosses, those medieval Christian mm-hmm. crosses, but he also has Macbeth's men are all carrying pitchforks.
Right.
So, yeah, so there's clearly like an identification with the satanic and the pagan mm-hmm. going on there. He also, Orson Welles also introduces a character, which is something that happens a lot. You introduce a character that condenses things.
Yeah.
And I think we have to talk about Ross in Polanski's mm-hmm. version, because he's my favorite introduced character. But in Orson Welles' version, they introduce the Holy Father. They introduce a guy who takes a bunch of the lines and basically acts as like a Christian voice.
Yes.
And he is the first person during the final showdown that Macbeth kills. He throws a spear at him and kills him. And then when he fights Macduff, before Macduff kills him, he knocks off the cross from his helmet.
Right.
Oh, yeah. No, there's everybody that approaches this play, one of the big questions you have to ask, at least when you do a Western version of it, is how are you going to deal with the religion aspect of it? Mm-hmm. How are you going to deal with paganism, Satanism, witchcraft versus the Christian forces that, you know, Christianity that would have been present during those times?
Sure. I mean, even in Throne of Blood, you have the Shintoism rearing its head. But, you know, particularly in the Western versions, how that's approached, like, you know, different filmmakers, how much credence they want to give to the paganism or just the supernatural aspects in general. Like, I think one thing that's become increasingly popular is to treat the supernatural occurrences as, you know, maybe some rational explanation for it, like that it's a psychological manifestation. I mean, one of my favorite scenes in the play, and just how it's realized in some of these films, is the appearance of Banquo's ghost. And like, the Polanski version, I think, does that so well, where it really rides that line, but it's almost like The Shining, the way it's cutting back and forth between Macbeth's face and then Bankbo's ghost, and how the ghost sort of changes with every edit, like the
Oh,
makeup's
absolutely.
changing, and like it's very scary actually. That's one of the scariest things. And like Polanski, like it does feel like it's sort of calling on the or pulling on the like psychological manifestations that you see in a film like Repulsion, I think especially, or there's some of that in Rosemary's Baby, of
Rosemary's
course.
Baby,
Yeah, and that's
where
all.
the question is all of this in Rosemary's
Right.
head, or is all of this real? That is certainly something that he introduces to his version of
So,
Macbeth.
like, that's like he's right, kind of writing that line of ambiguity. And then some of them, we haven't mentioned it yet, but like the Bellatar version, it's very sort of apparently psychological, I find. Like, that's just how it's
Well,
treated.
the Bellatar version, which, by the way, we should say something about the Bellatar version. On my local library's copy of Satan Tango, they also included Bellatar's television version of Macbeth, which preceded Satan Tango, which is an amazing version because it's done in about, I don't know, 50 minutes or an hour,
Right.
but it is also done only in two shots. Now the first shot is a few minutes long and it's the introduction and then there's some credits and then you go on and it's like a long 45-minute take. That's all cool. What's really impressive about the fact that he did a 45-minute take is that horses are involved. Which, I mean, has any other director directed a 45-minute single take with animals in it? I mean, that's amazing.
It's incredibly well choreographed. Well, like there's so many amazing moments. Like I think there's one shot where it's a close up on Lady Macbeth delivering this monologue, and the camera just kind of like lilts very organically over the banister, and that's when you see Macbeth murdering the king. Like it's just this perfect kind of feeling of pace and editing within a single long take. Like I think that's one thing that Bellatar at his best is very good at. I mean, his wife, Agnes Hranitzky, I know, like, she used to be the editor on all his films, and then when his style started changing up, like, eventually her position kind of moved to co-director. Like, she has the co-director credit, I think, from Werkmeister Harmonies onwards, because the editing, it's in camera. Like, when you're watching the Bellatar Macbeth, it still has the pace of something that's edited. It has, a sequence of images that change and move in front of you. It's just that there's no cuts between them. So, like, I think that's really interesting. And you can see him, sort of experimenting with that style that would dominate his most famous films.
Yeah, made for television. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely
Well, it was
amazing. And
like
it
his
just, it's.
student film, I think. Like, he was already kind of an established filmmaker, but that was sort of his graduate film, I guess, or student film. He basically went back to, relearn filmmaking. And I think he said his professor, when Bellatar was having trouble kind of like coming up with the stories, like, just pick something from classic literature. And his interview was kind of funny, where like Bellatar said, "I like Macbeth because it's just about this like ordinary middle class couple, and the wife's kind of bossy, and then they try and grab power, but they suck." Like, he sort of put it in those terms, where like he clearly like didn't think much of these two people, but he saw them as kind of like regular flawed people. And I think that actually translates really well in his version. Is like these are clearly two people trying to grab onto something way beyond them, right? They're not fitted for this sort of leadership. They're kind of like a trashy couple that just gets more than they can handle, bites off more than they can chew.
Oh, I love that. I love that version. I love your take of it. That is so never been my.
I mean,
I
yeah.
literally, I'm, I, I've read several critics of the play and people that talk about the movie say essentially that the horror of Macbeth is that he is the Mr. Hyde to all of our Dr. Jekyll. And I am one of those people that went the very first. I remember the very first time I read it, I was like, "Oh man, I understand everything that this guy's thinking." Up until a certain point,
Right.
he sort of makes it. He takes a wrong turn somewhere, and then you're like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa! Why is he doing that?" So I've never judged them. I've never thought of them as trashy. I've always thought that they were awesome.
Well, like Scotland PA, there's a comedy kind of adaptation of Macbeth that's done in the world of 70s fast food franchising, which
who knew that that was the perfect
like,
place?
I think like they definitely come across as kind of like trashy, right? Like, you know, I think like there it's perfectly acceptable to make judgments on them as characters because they're kind of ridiculous. It's so funny. Like, I still remember Lady Macbeth trying to get the grease stains off instead of the blood, like stuff like that. You know, it's a really, I think it's a funny movie. I haven't seen it for a long time, but
great soundtrack. Has Bad Company, and the first time that song comes on, Bad Company, you really get into it. Right. It's a trippy movie. What's cool about that is, as we discussed earlier, one of the reasons why Macbeth is so cinematic. Macbeth is cinematic because it has so much action. Mm-hmm. I mean, essentially, Macbeth is the original Game of Thrones.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I mean, this has everything.
Red
it has
Wedding
political...
ain't got nothing on the Mask or Macduff's, like, I think.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a play that really just delivers a lot in a short period of time. This is Shakespeare's shortest tragedy. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that makes it so cinematic is you can make so many coherent, logical decisions and still have the same play. And so you can do this play as a horror film, which a lot of people do. You can do this play as a ghost story, as a supernatural story. You can do this play purely from the psychological point of view. You can do this play as a black comedy. And that's what they decided to do in Scotland, PA, I think with mixed results, but certainly is interesting.
It's, yeah, I mean, it's got Christopher Walken. You can't be all that.
It has Christopher Walken.
You know.
When he starts talking about the French fry truck, it's amazing. He says, a French fry truck. Did I pronounce it correctly?
That's sort of like the beginning of like Walken doing Walken, kind of exaggerated, you know? But
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know. If people can get a hold of that, I think it's at least worth a watch. I mean, sometimes, like, I think you can still find the core story of Macbeth cropping up in other films that, like, aren't explicitly based on it. Like, I always thought of Scarface as kind of a Macbeth story, you know, where, like, at the very beginning, he's kills a guy to prove that he's loyal, and, you know, that kind of gets him this promotion, just like Macbeth at the beginning, and he's like, hey, I can accumulate power, and kills his boss basically and takes over and, you know, becomes king. And like I kind of like that instead of the witches, the prophecy comes from the Goodyear blimp just being like, the world is yours, you know, that's the prophecy coming to America. It's like a prophecy that, hey, you know, the world can be yours. And then the Lady Macbeth, it's a little bit split between the sister character and Michelle Pfeiffer, but like, you know, it's basically the same kind of trajectory, and, you know, it leads to the attack on the mansion at the end. It's like Burnham Wood come to Dunsinane when all the gangsters all turn on him and he's completely alone in this mansion with his M16 and grenade launcher. Like, you know, like I think it's basically Macbeth when you kind of get down to its core story, right?
Oh, I think no question. I think no question. What's interesting about this version of Macbeth, and people might be shocked when they hear me say this, but Tony Montagna is the most heroic version of Macbeth, I think, of all these adaptations.
Well, he's the version who doesn't kill the kids, yeah.
Yeah, he's the version who his downfall is not because he goes too far in murder, because it isn't, I mean, he does kill the police officer, and that's sort of the turning point for him, in that he has crossed over into a place where he is extremely vulnerable. But the police officer was a corrupt one. So you're not really, you don't disown Tony Montagna, I think, even though he's so much more violent. It's like, it's horrific violence that is in the beginning part of that movie, but you don't really turn against him, until I think he kills his best friend, until he kills the Banquo character. Yep. And that's it. Everybody else that gets it up until that point basically deserves it. And in fact, his downfall is not because he's gone too far, because he's been too ambitious. His downfall is because he has refused to commit this crime with people that are more powerful than he is. If anything, in Scarface, the villain of the movie is like capitalism in general. I mean, it is. It really is. I think there's a really strong argument. He makes the statement. He says, the only thing I have in this world is my word and my balls. Mm-hmm. And he is truly a courageous man who is committing like heinous crimes. But he has a certain code that nobody else around him has a code except for him. He's the only one that is trying to, you know, in his own way is trying to, he's trying to come up in Miami society and have money and success and power and all of that. But he is still adhering to a code in a world where nobody else is doing so. And the thing that leads to his downfall is the fact that he has too much integrity. So take that.
Yeah, I guess I will take that. Well, I'm curious, like, we've talked a little bit more about the outliers, but, like, is there a film version that you would say is the most faithful? Like, you know, would it be the Polanski version, you think? Or
yeah, this is a tough one because it all comes down to, like, what you think of as faithful, right?
We did talk, like, there are things about the Polanski version that are very atypical, and there are things that are very specifically Polanski. I mean, I feel like anytime you talk Polanski, like, it's so fraught to, like, start bringing in his personal life, which it should be, on many levels. But, you know, famously, his wife, pregnant wife Sharon Tate, was murdered. And, you know, like, it's sort of hard not to think of that when you're watching the scene where, you know, they have to tell Macduff that his family died, or, you know, when they're murdered.
Yeah, it is definitely hard to watch the 1971 Polanski Macbeth without thinking about the Manson family murders and mm-hmm. Sharon Tate and his unborn child and all of that. It is definitely hard to separate the two. And he really wanted people to separate the two. The way that people, the media treated this movie at that time and treated him in general, almost like blaming him for it because of making Rosemary's Baby and then... like a lot of that is a lot, and but still,
just wait, media, you'll get your chance to blame Polanski for something.
Wait a while, but no, there's absolutely a part of me that sees this movie and can't help but separate the two. And I don't think it's possible. This is the even though the 2010 Patrick Stewart version is a horror film, it does not have as it is not as horrifying as the Polanski version, and the people that watched it at that time were really, like, if you read the critical reviews, many of them were shocked at the violence. You know, Duncan is usually, the murder of Duncan is usually not shown, and here it's shown and it's brutal. The
it's
murders
a
are
a whole bunch of times, like, it's not just this, like, one clean stab and he's dead. Like, he's sort of waking up right when it happens. It's very uncomfortable to watch. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of fun, like, this was the version that they showed in high school when I was...
Was it really?
Yeah, so, and I remember, like, the sort of talking, explaining before we watched it, like, it wasn't on the violence, it was on the nudity, which is sort of funny now. Because, like, one of the first images, it's, like, somebody being flayed with a mace or Morningstar-type weapon, their back being ripped open. Like, it's very violent, it's very horrific, so much in the movie. And, like... You know, I mean, the Bagbo scene is horrific in the way that a horror film is, but, like, a lot of it's horrific in the way that life can be, which is, you know, sort of upsetting.
Yeah, no. So you asked the question of which is the most faithful. And so the question becomes, faithful to what? Faithful to the way that Shakespeare intended the play to be portrayed versus, like, historically faithful. Like, what would it have actually have been? What was it like back in, you know, the 11th century? And I think if depending on which question you ask, you get different responses, right?
Right.
So I think one of the main questions you always ask is, how much of this is supernatural? How much of this is being driven by forces outside of human control? Versus how much of this is Macbeth and his own psychology and his own ambition and his relationship with his wife. And I think from the very beginning, it was a mixture of both. But I think depending on how much you make in that mixture, right? So, like, I think Shakespeare probably intended, because Shakespeare's audience, particularly the king at that time, King James I, was a true believer in witchcraft and Satanism, and in fact wrote a dissertation in 1597 about how you should hunt down witches and different versions. And Shakespeare basically stole sentences from it, stole rituals from James's version. He really wanted King James to see this play and buy into it.
Right.
And so when you look at that, you think, oh, okay, so the witches are real. And a lot of the supernatural is real because that's the time that they were living in. And if you think of it from that perspective, I actually think the most faithful version then is probably the Patrick Stewart version of 2010, because there they take the supernatural. The supernatural is real. Those witches, they are like, they're out for blood. And that is a real component of that world. And they're not just some metaphors. I mean, they're metaphors as well, but they're supposed to be taken as real. And so I think that is probably more of the tone that Shakespeare himself would have put on the stage. I think historically, I think you have to go with the Polanski version. That is a play that is it feels like life is short, nasty, brutish. Like, it feels like you are in the state of nature, as Scotland would have been at that time, and you understand like why somebody would have been as brutal as Macbeth was, watching that Polanski version. I think that's probably the most historically accurate, although it's, you know, not historically accurate, but taken from that perspective, that's probably the most faithful adaptation.
Out brief candle, life's but a walking shadow. You really feel that in that one, where it's just, yeah, life ends hard and bad, and it's sort of, you know, brutal. Like, it's incredibly brutal, the story. I mean, there's other Shakespeare stories that have that kind of brutality too, you know, like Titus Andronicus is very brutal, but I think it's that sort of combination.
You can't empathize with anybody in Titus Andronicus.
Right, yeah.
There's nobody in Titus Andronicus where you're like, oh, that's me. Sure. Nobody looks at Aaron Moore, Aaron the Moor, and says, oh, that's me. Whereas, yeah, the other thing about Polanski's Macbeth, though, is that the most shocking death in Macbeth is not Duncan. It's not Macbeth at the end. A spoiler alert, Macbeth dies at the end. No, but it's the traitor. That scene where the traitor is, he's chained up by the neck, and then he's just dropped suddenly and has a jerk at the bottom.
Like a metal chain instead of a rope. It's, ugh.
I feel bad saying it. I feel bad talking about it because I don't want people to vision that have seen the movie to recall that vision, because it's really. But the first time I saw that, I like jerked up in my seat and was like, okay,
did the exact I'm gonna same have thing to watch watching this. It this time.
I was like, I'm going to have to pay attention to what's going on here.
You kind of see it. Like, most of the films, you know, there's sort of like a cutaway when somebody drops and hangs. Or, like, I think in the Orson Welles version, you have somebody being hung and it's just done with the shadow. This, like, you see somebody drop and jerk and it's, ugh, it's horrible.
Or you see in the Orson Welles version, you see somebody's feet because they're hanging by the rope of the bell.
Yes.
And so, like, yeah, it's totally. And most of the time you don't see like the death of Duncan here. You see him stabbed not only in the chest, but you see him stabbed through the neck. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a brutal version. And I think really brings home the horror that would have been power politics in 11th sure. century Scotland.
Because, like, I was thinking the most recent Macbeth, the one with Marion Cotillard and Michael Fassbender, like, that one really, like, on one hand, it feels like it's trying to actually put you in that period in Scotland's history. You know, there's attention to sort of historical detail that a lot of these films skip over, you know, even though, like, obviously Shakespeare wrote centuries after when it's meant to take place. But, like, I think, you know, what you said about the tone being faithful, like, I think something about the total inconsistencies of that recent Macbeth is kind of what threw me off. Like, sometimes it feels like it's trying to be realistic, other times it feels like it's trying to be 300, you know. So
so the most recent Macbeth does a couple of things that are really kind of cool, right?
Yes.
So when you read the play very carefully, there's a part where Lady Macbeth mentions that she has nursed a child.
Yeah.
Which means that at some point in the past, even though they're childless at this point, at some point in the past, she has had a child, whether it's from a previous marriage or whether it's from her marriage to Macbeth. And what's and on top of that, on top the other thing, so that's a little bit of Lady Macbeth's
psychology.
It just
blew my mind because I never thought that it could have been from a previous marriage. I never thought of that.
Well, as you pointed out with the power marriages and all of that, no, like, it's absolutely a possibility.
Yeah.
But then on the flip side, Macbeth's psychology, when we're introduced to Macbeth in most of the movies, we're introduced to him when he's talking to Banquo and he's unruined and he's sort of like this cool guy, like he's an everyman soldier guy, and you're like, I like that guy. And then he eventually becomes, you know, he becomes a murderous psychopath. But in the Kurzel version, he does a pretty cool job of being like, no, like, this is a guy who just fought. I think the description of it was as if to memorize Golgotha, as if to memorize Calvary, you know, the place where Jesus was crucified. I mean, this was somebody who had just fought a very bloody battle where he cut somebody from the belly button to the chin with his sword, which, from everything that I've read about military history, the people that were involved in sword battles were just like, they had intense PTSD because it was such a horrifying way to fight.
Yes.
And this is a guy who had just done that and done it really, really well. And so he's not, his hands are already bloody by the time he shows up and we see him hanging out with Banquo and he meets those witches. And this film, I think, does the best job of depicting both of those potential backstories for the characters.
Okay.
Now, at different points, he certainly, I agree with you, Kurzel, goes off in the wrong direction. And yeah, by the end of it, you're like, I don't understand what I just watched. But I think both of those things are kind of cool things to explore about both of those characters' backstory.
No, that's a good point. And, you know, if he is suffering from a post-traumatic stress or something like that, I mean, like, one thing I really like about the Orson Welles version is you feel so in Macbeth's headspace in the geography of the film. Like, I think it's sort of a byproduct of that being kind of made with a shoestring budget, because, like, it does look kind of stagey for the most part, but he gets around a lot of that by creating sort of an abstract environment, an abstract space. Like, I sort of suspect he was borrowing a lot from expressionist cinema. Like, there's scenes where the shadows and everything, like, it looks straight out of Caligari, so it sort of makes sense that it's a little bit of an expressionist Macbeth, and that as the landscape's getting more sparse and abstract, it's like his mental state, you know, it's more empty and more barren and horrible, you know, and it, like, it sort of works the way, you know, he's the king over nobody, like, everyone's gone by the end, it's just him, you know, in this sort of empty space. Like, that I found really interesting. And then the minimalist Macbeth, the one with Ian McKellen and Judi Dench, like, that kind of takes it a step further by putting it, you know, it's sort of like most abstract state, like, forget about sets, like, this is almost like a precursor to like Dogville, I guess, but like it almost feels like some of these characters, in a way, when they walk off their scene, they stop existing, and, you know, when they walk out of their darkness, that's them coming into existence, and that it's this, like, sort of purely abstract expression of the story, you know. I kind of like that, actually, that it's almost like for Macbeth and for Lady Macbeth, the world only exists in its immediacy and relevance to them, and that, like, they're not concerned with anything outside of this, like, tiny dark little sphere that they live in, you know. Like, it's something about that effect I really like about that version.
Well, considering at times how you kind of feel they have the moral understanding of the universe as, like, children would have. So it makes sense that they would lack object permanence. That once you can't see something, that it exists anymore. I've heard Ian McKellen talk about that play. He is wildly proud of that production. Mm-hmm. I think everybody associated with that production is, like,
that's
really proud
great,
of it.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was like a historical version. I think that's the movie that a lot of people see when they see Macbeth, and a lot of people find it very horrifying. In terms of the Orson Welles version, that set, I don't care how shoestring the budget was, I love that set.
He embraces the sort of jankiness of it, and you have those, like, sharp edges, and it looks like it looks apocalyptic, you know.
It looks like he's in a cave, or when there's hell porter, when the porter goes to open the gate, like, he's opening Hellgate. When you enter into Macbeth's court, like, you are entering a hellish cavern. It's awesome. And, you know, the soldiers all have pitchforks. It also reminds me a little bit of Ken Russell's The Devils.
Right, yeah.
The set that they have in The Devils, although obviously The Devil set was one of the greatest sets ever made for a movie. This does not get to that level, but it's still it's awesome. And some of the things that they do with banners and some of the crosses, I think he did a really good job of maximizing his dollars. I think the other thing about the Orson Welles version is Orson Welles is my favorite Macbeth. And the reason for that is not just because I really like Orson Welles, but because every single version, Macbeth is a man that goes through many stages in his life. And I believe Orson Welles in every one of those versions. I believe him as a courageous warrior.
Yes.
I believe him as a regal king. I believe him as a debauched, a paranoid who doesn't trust anybody around him. Mm-hmm. And I definitely believe him as like that hubris. I know I'm going to die. I know everybody has abandoned me and I don't care. I'm making my final stand because, you know, shakes his fist at the heavens. Like, I believe Orson Welles in every single version of Macbeth that he portrays in a way that I don't for any, you know, more so than I do for any other performer, any of the other greats that have played Macbeth.
I think that sort of character transformation, that is something you revisited a couple of times. He's great at it. I think that's a lot of his personal life, I think, kind of filtered through.
It's him in every single time he's ever tried to make a movie.
Yeah. No, like, I mean, one of my favorite shots, maybe my favorite shot in the whole Orson Welles Macbeth, it's when he's standing there and he's got that, like, crown where the spikes are kind of going out and he's holding the staff and it casts this long shadow and he's so alone and it's like... You sort of feel that way about Orson Welles sometimes when you watch his later films. Like, you think of, you know, like, they always, oh, Orson Welles, the one-man band. You know, like, he's the king, but he's alone. So, like, that's kind of how you feel about this guy.
When you think about the romantic, you know, the romantic version of the hero, you know, yes. The artist or the, you know, the Lucifer when he's fallen from heaven. Basically, anybody that shakes their fist at the heaven that says, you know, I understand I am strapped into this mortal coil. I only have a finite life. And, you know, I may not have any power. I may not be important. I may not be very talented. But God damn it, I'm going to fight back with everything I have, even if it leaves me alone and broken. You know, sort of the Daniel Plainview character or so many other characters. But when Orson Welles does that, you just believe, like,
yeah, yeah.
That is a guy who absolutely is living it. He's not acting it. He's living it.
Mm-hmm. I heard that, like, when he turned in, because, like, it was famously sort of recut, his version of Macbeth, and dubbed and futzed with, like a lot of his films were. But I think they said one of the studio's issues was there's too much Orson Welles. And he's like, well, the play's called Macbeth. Like, I think that's actually, like, one thing that works about it, feeling like a little bit like a vanity project in some way, where, like, he's at the center and he's going to be Macbeth, is just, like, you know, the character's dominated by ego in the same way that the film is, you know, like, that translates really well. And I think makes it very compelling. So I was really curious. It's too bad. I think it was never filmed, or maybe it was filmed and lost, but, like, he had done, he had directed a play of Macbeth in the 30s with
Voodoo Macbeth?
Yeah, the Harlem Macbeth one? Yeah, like, I would have loved to see a film version of that. When you see, like, some of the costume drawings and everything, like, it almost looks like Emperor Jones.
Oh, I would have loved that. I also would have loved to been at his... He did Macbeth in Salt Lake City prior to filming Macbeth.
Okay.
And from what I understand, that was also amazing. He blacked out all the lights at the beginning of the play when everybody was seated in the theater, and then marched 9 bagpipers up and down the aisle until eventually there's like an explosion in the orchestra pit, and the witches come up and start. And it just sounds like it was breathtaking. So yeah, no, it's we definitely lost something when we didn't get to see the Orson Welles versions of Macbeth.
Right.
There's no question. I wish I could go back in time and check out those plays.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ephemeral nature of theater, and that's sort of one thing that's kind of both amazing and too bad about it, is when you go and watch a play, hey, like, you know, this is maybe the only time it'll happen this particular way. It's all live. It's all, you know, some potential for spontaneity, you know, and it might never be played like that again. You'll never see it with this cast again, or, like, you know, that always is bound to happen. So, like, people kind of talk about, oh, it's like crummy when you just have like the filmed play versions. But I like those too sometimes, just to see what people did with them. It's not the same as watching it live, you know, and it's not necessarily cinematic, but just to get a sense of something as a record, you know. I wish some of these play versions, were available.
So going back into how I got into all of this, I started reading Shakespeare for the fairly bizarre reason in that I was getting into trivia, and I was recently on a game show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, here in the United States. And I've been, one of the main things you need to know for trivia is Shakespeare's body of work, and I didn't have that as a background, so I started really getting into that. And part of that was I also started to go to the theater. And what I realized from going to the theater, when the theater is good, there's nothing better. It is the highest form of entertainment. When theater is on, it's amazing. What you also notice, though, is that the same play, which can be amazing on day one, if the actors don't have that same connection, that same rhythm, the same sharing of energy, the next performance, the very same play with the same people can be not good the next day.
Right, right. I know exactly what you mean. Like, I've done a little bit of theater work. Like, it happens sometimes. You just have like an off night, or like the audience, you can almost feel it where like the audience just isn't quite receptive, and that gets in your head, or like things like that. You can just, it's different sometimes from night to night, and if sometimes an actor forgets their line and you just keep going, you know, like stuff like that happens. Or do you remember when people were going to that that Spider-Man musical? I think like Julie Taymor was involved, and like that was like the appeal of it was just
It was the hardest. They never took it out of previews because they thought that they knew the reviews were going to be so bad. But because it was such a scandal, the tickets were the most, like the hardest. It was essentially Hamilton. It was so hard to get those tickets. And Julia Taymor is, she's one of the great living Shakespearean directors. So the whole thing is so amazing. Now, that's a really great, I'm really glad you brought that up. Anytime you want to do a podcast episode about the forgotten Spider-Man, episode turn off the dark of Spider-Man.
Or... turn on the dark or turn off the dark. It was like something weird like that, right? She must have done Macbeth on stage, Julie Taymor, right?
Well, I know. So she did the...
She hasn't done a film, but...
She did the Titus Andronicus film.
Oh, I love the Titus film. It's so cool.
Oh, me too. And it really...
Her Tempest is pretty cool, too. I like that as well.
She did A Midsummer's Night Dream, which is supposed to be amazing, but I haven't found a way to get a copy of it. She did, and they did like a filmed version. They filmed a performance of it, and it looks amazing. So I need to catch that at some point as well.
Yeah, and since we're talking Macbeth on stage stories, like just to how engaging it can be. Like I remember going to see a play version of Macbeth in Stratford, Ontario, with my younger brother more than 10 years ago, and he was young enough; he didn't know the story at all. So we would get Macbeth and Macduff confused. it was just so engaging on stage. Like, you know, for a little kid who didn't know anything about Shakespeare, like, he was totally into it. And I remember just, like, at the very end, when Macduff kills Macbeth, he, like, leaned over to me. He's like, "Who's the Macbeth now?" Which, like, it was fun seeing somebody get, like, excited about the play and get totally engaged, you know. And I think, like, that's maybe also a quality of Macbeth in particular out of Shakespeare's plays, is that you can look at it very intellectually and philosophically and, you know, in a very highbrow way, but you can also just like enjoy it without any kind of context. It's this, you know, great sort of violent, scary, easy to follow story in some respects, right? Like the core of the story is very simple, and it's just sort of in the nuances you can kind of go all the way down into its depth. Like, I think, you know, if you're going to show a kid like King Lear, like, I don't think you'd necessarily have the same result.
I'm 36. I still don't think I understand King Lear. So, yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think in my high school, I got Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, Hamlet, and King Lear.
Right.
And I never got Macbeth. I didn't read Macbeth until I was in grad school, and it had nothing to do with my studies. It was just something I wanted to read. What an epic disaster. What a, like, I don't know what the education reason was for not giving us Macbeth, but I think if I were doing the planning for an English classes in high school, I would put Macbeth first.
Yeah, Macbeth and maybe Romeo and Juliet are probably like the two ones.
I want to mention two things. Polanski does a great job of creating a new character. That Ross character, yeah. The totally amoral Machiavel character that is both his right, both Macbeth's right hand man in committing his dastardly deeds. But then, as soon as
he takes
feels
off at the end too, like he's just no
and
loyalty.
Without really, he just sort of like, meh. Okay, you didn't give me my thaneship that I deserve. So all right, yep. I'm gonna go to Macduff, whose family I just helped slaughter, by the way, and I'm gonna hug him and say, we need to go back to England. We need to go back to Scotland.
I mean, that's
and
the
take
whole
it.
Like. You know, if you're somebody like Macbeth, you're going to keep company like that. Like, who are you going to get to do your dirty work? Like, I think that's a really great choice, actually.
Oh, yeah. He's totally the Steve Bannon who totally just at the first chance sure. jumped ship. But the great thing about him is he has none of the moral conflict that Macbeth and Lady Macbeth has. He sleeps well. He sleeps soundly every single night. And I just – there's something about that character which is totally hypnotic, and I'm so happy – and totally nihilistic and is a real – he's like the personification, I think, of Polanski's version of Macbeth, which I think has a lot going for it. So I really enjoy adding that. One thing that gets subtracted from a lot of Shakespeare Macbeth adaptations that makes me sad is the discussion between Malcolm and Macduff, where Malcolm essentially says, anything that Macbeth can do evil, I can do eviler. And right. then eventually he walks it back and says, no, I'm just kidding. But that, for me, is the other thing about the – like, that is the ultimate nihilism, is it doesn't matter who is in power. You're going to have somebody who's going to be sullied by power and is going to take advantage of it no matter who it is. And even though that's not my personal beliefs about the world, that's not my personal beliefs about mm-hmm. politics, gosh, that's like – that's such a – it's a message that is crafted so well in the play, and I get sad whenever that section gets cut.
Huh. I'll keep that in mind if I ever adapt it. I'm trying to think, like, who would make a good Macbeth film? You know who I would actually love to see do a Macbeth film is Robert Eggers, who did The Witch. That kind of takes place close to the time Macbeth would have been written, I think, like maybe a little bit later.
Oh, absolutely. Like, no, if it's the Salem witch trials or right before that.
Their lines and the way, like, you know, in The Witch, the way the supernatural aspects are treated, or have you seen it?
I love The Witch.
Okay. Like, you know how those supernatural aspects feel completely real to these characters and you can completely accept them, but there's still ambiguity in their psychology. And the way this, like, very period-specific dialogue, like, the way it sounds in Ralph Ineson and Kate Dickie, like, even them as a couple, like, that's not so different from Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, maybe, you know? Like, I think
oh, yeah.
if Robert Eggers ever did a version of Macbeth, I would completely love that. Like, to me, The Witch, like, that's the kind of tone I wish maybe existed. I'm not sure there's a film version of Macbeth that quite hits that.
That is a great selection. That is a great selection. I would argue that the Polanski version comes pretty close, but I get your point.
It comes close.
It would be pretty great to have. Robert Eggers would do a great job. So I hadn't thought of this question, but now just sitting here thinking about it, I have a good one too. I think David Fincher would crush at adapting okay. Macbeth, because he's a guy who every movie he makes has an ominous tone.
Like a contemporary set version? Like if he set it in
Yeah, absolutely. I think he would do a contemporary version, but I mean, he could do one in Facebook.
Right.
He could do one in like an internet company. I mean, whatever. It doesn't matter. Wherever he decided to set it, it would feel ominous. It would feel dark. I think he, in every movie he makes, you know, Seven, I think he just captures a certain tone that would make a perfect Macbeth.
Okay. I like that.
Before this morning, I had a favorite Macbeth. Before this morning, my ranking went my ranking went Polanski's version first and then Patrick Stewart version second. But this morning I rewatched Throne of Blood for now the third time, and man, Kurosawa is hard to beat. Some of his changes to the plot, just how beautiful his version of no theater depicted on film.
I think maybe you could say, like, even though it's very theatrical in its style, like drawing on the no theater, like, I mean, the actress who plays Asashi, like, her face just looks exactly like one of those no theater masks, the way she holds
yes.
it. I guess, you know, the no theater, because the you're using a mask, you have to use subtle gestures and use light to kind of change the expression. Like, she does that with her face, and the way she talks, like, it's almost like her lips are barely moving, you know. She's very still, but you still get so much expression out of her. So, like, I think even though the style's very theatrical in the makeup, and it's sort of the precursor to a lot of Kurosawa's later films, it's maybe the most cinematic version of Macbeth, I might say. Like,
I agree.
You know, you just forget that you're watching something that was ever meant to be something other than a film.
I agree. I think his depiction of the witch or the spirit is just terrific. His work with the elements, filming around Mount Fuji, as well as that fog.
Oh, I love the fog. Like, when they just disappear into it and then come out again, and you're like, "What was there a cut in there? I can't even tell." Like, or are they just going in circles? Yeah,
it's otherworldly. But overall, that. The reason why this viewing of it really sold me on this version, and I still love the Polanski version, and I think the 2010 Patrick Stewart version is amazing. The thing that really sold me, though, is that the metaphysical element of Throne of Blood, the idea of this, you mentioned Shintoism. I saw it more as like Zen Buddhism. This idea that as long as we are ambitious, as long as we are continuing to try to pursue our selfish desires, this is going to happen ad infinitum. But when I watched it for that, I realized, like, this, even though it's Japanese, even though it's totally different from anything that Shakespeare probably could have ever imagined, this had a different component. This had the same theological and metaphysical wrestling that I think Shakespeare really would have enjoyed. Just take it and put it in a different context, and it resonates with me, and it adds something. Kurosawa adds a lot to what is already a tremendous play when he made this movie, and it is truly, just a cinematic masterpiece. A lot of people consider it the best Shakespeare adaptation, period. So this has pole vaulted, this has overleaped into mm-hmm. the first position for me after watching it today.
Beautifully put. So I don't know, what's a good quote to end out on?
Oh, you have to end out with the out, out, brief candle.
Do you want to do like the Shakespeare moan? Like, oh, out, out, brief candle. No, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and is heard no more. It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
But you know what? I think we had a terrific conversation today. I think we had a terrific conversation, Martin, and I think that signifies something.
Well, thank you for coming on. That was a lot of fun. And if folks want to find you on the internet, is there anywhere where they can look?
Absolutely. So check out my podcast, Film Baby Film. So find me at filmbabyfilm.com or Film Baby Film on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. Also on Twitter, again, Film Baby Film, Instagram, the whole thing. I'm everywhere on the internet, so definitely check me out.
I really like the Film Baby Film episode you did of Roadside Picnic and Stalker. That was a lot of fun to listen to.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. We've done a few book and movie comparisons and discussions, and this is certainly something that's, just as somebody who likes to read and watch movies, certainly is a fun thing to discuss both media formats.
Mm-hmm. No, if you ever want to do a Stragatsky Brothers follow-up, I'm maybe the biggest Hard to Be a God fan in this hemisphere. So
I just bought Hard to Be a God, and I'm thinking that okay. I need to watch that soon.
Okay, because I've read the book, I've seen both film versions, I've watched the new one like so many times. If you ever want to talk about that, that might be a fun one.
Well, yeah, no, Martin, you're one of the best conversations. We've had a few really good conversations. I would love to talk to you anytime about anything, so could certainly cool. put something on the books if you're interested.
Okay. And until next time, listeners, take care and look out for witches. I wouldn't trust them, I tell you. Bye.